Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to come in and give this seminar, and I must say I'm enjoying very much being at Cambridge. It's lovely being here. I know this is a commercial centre, and my interest in this subject of reversionary interest really grew out of a chapter that I wrote initially in a talks book on interests and goods, the talks relating to chattels, conversion and so on. And of course that's very much linked with interest very broadly in goods that commercial lawyers mainly take an interest in, and we all love the Nemodac rule and all that kind of thing. So the topic that I thought I'd talk about today, reversionary interests, I find intriguing because it seems to me unnecessarily complicated, and my view of it is this could be simplified somewhat, which is really what this paper's about. Please feel free to disagree with me, as Stephen will. You will testify that I don't get upset when people disagree with me. I say this because I once gave a paper at an SLS conference where everybody, I think, in the audience disagreed wholeheartedly with me. So, but I took it, didn't I, Stephen? I still think that...
you won't be wrong.
So, well... reversionary interests arise in the context where plaintiffs are wishing to sue in the torts relating to chattels, principally these days conversion and negligence. Of course, we're talking also about trespass to chattels. In the UK, debt in lieu as a tort has been abolished. That's not the case in New Zealand. We don't have an equivalent statute to your Torts Interference with Goods Act. So debt in lieu is still on the books, but nearly every case of debt in lieu is conversion, so this isn't a particular issue. And these days, I think nearly every case of trespass is also negligence. If we included deliberate acts of damage to chattels as being negligence, I think the fields would be completely covered. Bearing in mind there's no debt in lieu in England, I'm not paying any attention to that. That's of no particular significance anyway now. The issue here is the position of an owner of goods who is not in possession of them when goods are taken away, damaged, wrongfully dealt with by some third party while they're in the possession of a bailee, normally we're talking about here. And what happens in that case to the position of the owner of the goods, what kind of rights does he or she have? Initially, the first question is, well, what is the arrangement between bailor and bailee? Of course, owners may part with possession of goods under all sorts of arrangements. And we're familiar with the idea of bailments at will, in which a bailee must return the goods on demand to a bailor, and other bailments in which the bailor has no right to return that immediate return of the goods. So that's generally a matter of looking at the contract between the parties. So if we look for this purpose at two simple cases, let's say that a car owner lends his car to a friend for a month, and while it's in the possession of the friend, the car's taken away or damaged, taken away and damaged by a stranger. The law in that case will permit either the owner, the bailor, to sue the stranger in conversion or trespass or negligence. But if, let's suppose, the arrangement between the bailor and his friend was that the payment was a payment given, $1, by the friend to the bailor for the use of the car for a month. If the stranger removed the car, damaged it within that period of a month, the only person with the ability to sue in conversion or trespass or negligence, to sue the third party who took away or damaged the car, would be the friend, the bailee. The owner of the car would have no right whatever to sue in either of those torts. And the reason for this is that the law protects possession when it comes to issues of interests in goods that are the subject of those torts. So if the stranger takes the car away, keeps it, damages it, destroys it, if there's a contract between the owner and his friend, if the support of the arrangement, the bailment is supported by consideration such that the bailor wouldn't have any right to have possession of the car, then the only person who may sue the third party is the friend, the bailee. So in that case, it hinges purely on the arrangement between the two parties. Now, the bailee who sues for goods, for wrongful interference with goods, is entitled to recover the whole value of the goods, or their loss of value if they're not completely destroyed or gone, regardless of whether or not the bailee has suffered any loss. So the position then, it's entirely in the hands of the bailee can sue and recover. Obviously, if the bailee recovers more than his or her loss, the bailee will have to account to the bailor for the difference. The right of the bailee to sue, which in effect is affirming the position that possession is what these torts protect, is long established. It was once doubtful. There were some cases in the 19th century that didn't accept this. For example, in the case of Ruth and Wilson, there was a plaintiff who didn't own a horse but had been given possession of it for a night. He put it into a field where there was a problem with a fence. The neighbour had neglected to repair the fence and the horse fell and died. The plaintiff, the bailee, claimed the value of the horse, and the defendant, who had neglected the fence, objected, saying the bailee had no sufficient property to claim. The court there allowed the bailee to maintain the suit, not only because he was in possession of the horse, but also because he was potentially liable to the owner of it for having put the horse in an area that the horse must be dangerous. So the court there was influenced by the fact that the bailee would be answerable to the bailor for any damage that happened to the horse, albeit that it may have been contributed to or caused by a third party. A later case followed that, Claridge in South Staffordshire, and another case about horses, 19th century cases often are, was in that case delivered by its owner into the hands of an auctioneer for sale, was injured in consequence of being frightened by the defendant's steam car, which was driven at an excessive speed. Here, the auctioneer was not liable to the owner of the horse. There was no fault on the part of the auctioneer. The fault was entirely that of the defendant who had the steam car. And it was held here that the auctioneer, as a bailee with no more than possession of the horse, could not claim against the steam car owner. It was argued that the auctioneer's possession was sufficient title for the action. This was rejected by the court, who said that if a person were in charge of a chattel and the possession was interfered with, that person could bring an action, but only for the damage that he himself had suffered. And in this case, the plaintiff, the bailee, the auctioneer, had suffered no damage at all because that person, the auctioneer, could not have been liable to the owner because the auctioneer had caused no damage. The damage was caused by a third party. So the court there ruled out the possibility that a bailee could be liable, could be able to recover loss. Later, these cases were overruled by the well-known case of the Winkfield, where the court said that there was no concern or issue here as to whether a bailor might owe some kind of obligation to the bailee in negligence. A third party who injured property could be answerable to a bailee, and the third party had no concern to inquire into the arrangement between the bailor and the bailee. In the Winkfield, you'll remember, I expect, the was a case of two ships colliding at sea, and one of them contained a quantity of mail. And the Postmaster General, who was regarded as the bailee with custody of the mail at that point, sued the owner of the ship that had collided with the ship carrying the mail in negligence. Now, of course, the Postmaster General himself did not own the mail. He was rightfully in possession of it. At first instance, the court said, well, the Postmaster General had no interest to protect. He was not the owner, he was only in possession. None of it was his fault. He could not bring any claim against the other ship owner in negligence. On appeal, the court said this was not the case, that the cases to the contrary had been well considered. And the court reviewed the authorities there and supported the principle that possession was sufficient title to sue on the part of the bailee. And the relationship between the bailor or the bailee and the bailee was of no relevance at all to a third party wrongdoer. And the court said, by analogy with finders of goods, people who have no right or title to goods other than the fact of having lawfully acquired possession, such people could protect their possession, could protect the goods by actions and conversion, and or detinue, trespass, negligence. And there was no reason, said the court, why they shouldn't apply equally to a bailee. And this was because the person with possession had the property. And as against a wrongdoer, said the court, possession is title. The chattel that's been converted, destroyed, taken away, whatever the tort is deemed to be the chattel of the possessor and of nobody else, and therefore its loss or deterioration is a loss to him. And his obligation to account to the bailor is absolutely nothing to do with it, said the court. This could be sorted out subsequently as between bailor and bailee as to what their obligations to each other might be, and it would be necessary afterwards, after determining whether the third party was liable, to look at the relative interests of the bailor and the bailee. But as between the wrongdoer, the third party wrongdoer, and the bailee, there was no question, no need to inquire into the relationship between bailor and bailee. However, if the bailee recovered the whole value of the goods or recovered more than the cost of his or the value of his own interest in the goods, then he would have to account to his bailor, and that's in the court, so it's very well established. Now the bailee then has the possessory title, and lines of cases since then have affirmed that, has the necessary possessory title to sue for interference with the goods. That right is exclusive to the bailee, though, only if the bailee has an exclusive right to possession of the goods. So if the bailor has no right to regain possession of the goods, let's say the goods are on hire purchase, something of that kind, some contractual arrangement whereby the bailee has exclusive right to keep possession of the goods as against the owner of them, then in that case, the bailee will have the exclusive right to sue the third party who damages or converts the goods. If, though, it's a bailment at will, one in which the bailor is entitled to recover the goods at any time, then bailor and bailee have concurrent rights to sue the third party tortfeasor, the person who takes or damages the goods. And this was discussed in the case, in the English case of O'Sullivan and Williams. In that case, there was a car was parked, it belonged to its owner, but it was in the possession of the owner's girlfriend who was borrowing it while the owner was away. The car was damaged irreparably by a third party who dropped something on it and damaged it. The owner claimed the value of the losses from the third party, the tortfeasor, and sought both the value of the car and compensation for loss of its use. This claim was settled as between the two of them, so the owner and the Port Fraser settled the claim. Subsequently, the girlfriend, the owner's girlfriend, who was the bailee, who had been in possession of it at the time that this event occurred, commenced proceedings against the defendant, the Port Fraser, who damaged the car for nervous shock. She got very upset. She wasn't in the car, but she saw it being damaged, and she had to have time off work and have fainting fits and so on. And she also claimed for loss of the car and inconvenience because she, as the borrower of it, had had the right to use it. The nervous shock claim was dismissed. It was held it was maintainable, but it was dismissed. The loss of use claim was, at first instance, allowed. On appeal, it was held that she, the girlfriend, as a bailee, could not bring an action for loss of use, because the bailor had settled the matter. Bailor and bailee, this being a bailment of will, there was no contract between the owner and his girlfriend, he simply lent the car, he could therefore require its return at any time. And in that situation, said the court, the owner and his girlfriend, the bailor and the bailee, had concurrent rights to bring an action. The action they were bringing, though, was for the same thing, for loss of use, and they couldn't both bring an action as against the tortfeasor. There couldn't be separate claims brought by bailor and bailee for exactly the same loss of use. The bailor, the owner, had settled the claim. His right to use the car included the right to allow his girlfriend to use it. Having settled it, his girlfriend, the bailee, then had no enforceable interest to protect, and she could not maintain any action for the loss of use of the vehicle. The court added that she would have been, you know, claimed to succeed, but the nervous shock one was a maintainable claim because it was quite a different cause of action. It didn't overlap with the bailee's claim for loss of use. So, in the case where there's a bailment, well, both bailee and bailor have concurrent rights. Not the case when there's a contract, and there are a large number of cases in which goods are subject to hire purchase, reservation of property clauses and so on, where the owner has no right vis-a-vis the bailee to get the goods back at will, and therefore, in a case like this, the bailor, the owner, is excluded from possession by that contract. The question then arises, well, what interest does that person have? Because the case law establishes very clearly that these chattel torts, conversion, negligence and so on, rest upon a possessory right, not a proprietary right, not a right of ownership. The action there that is used is called damage to a reversionary interest. There's something I understand some land. I'm not a land lawyer, it's a great mystery to me, but I think it's a very similar interest, where the law takes the view that even though there is no possessory right, we're talking about goods again, the owner has a reversionary interest which is retained in the goods. A straightforward example of this is a New Zealand case, an old case, Checker Taxi Cab Company and Stone. In that case, a taxi which the driver had hired from its owner, was damaged in a collision with a third party, was held that the owner could not sue the third party in conversion or any of the torts, the traditional torts, but could sue for his any damage to his reversionary interest, any injury done to it while his own possessory right was suspended while the car was on hire. Now, this distinction is an important one between a possessory and a reversionary interest in this case, particularly where the recovery of damages is in consideration. Because a bailee is regarded as having complete title vis-a-vis a stranger, a bailee may sue to recover the whole value of the goods. That's what's been lost. If somebody converts the goods, takes the land, doesn't bring them back, the bailee may recover the whole value of the goods or whatever the damage might be to them, if it's not a complete removal of the goods. By contrast, the holder of a reversionary interest, the owner, can recover no more than his or her actual loss. This is illustrated in another New Zealand case, Cameron and Phelps. In that case, the owner of this, this was a case that went on the West Coast during Europe. I don't know if you've come across this case, but Justice Fogarty, who's a judge in New Zealand, considered that the wild West Coast might have rules of its own to some extent, but that didn't affect the outcome of the case. They're the owner of a gold screening machine. There's a lot of gold mining goes on in that area. It agreed to sell it to two purchasers for 10 ounces of gold at a time worth about $6,000. And the contract contained a reservation of property clause whereby the owner was entitled to get the machine back if he wasn't paid. The purchasers allowed another pair of people to use it, and these people made considerable alterations to it and improved it. And eventually the gold mining undertaking fell apart, and the two people who had taken possession of the machine and improved it sold the machine for $30,000. They were aware that the owner, they were aware of the position of the owner, the existence, and the contract between him and the people who had agreed to purchase it. So they sold it knowing that belonged to somebody else in effect. But they themselves had spent money and time on improving the machine. The owner claimed in the district court initially, claiming the cost of the value of the machine, and the district court judge took the view that the owner had no more because there was a reservation of a property clause in the contract between the owner and the purchasers. The district court took the view that the owner had only a reversionary interest in the machine and therefore was not entitled to anything more than his actual loss. The argument being, the judge's view being that the owner's interest would be only a reversionary one because there was a reservation of property clauses between the purchaser. The district court held that the owner was only entitled to the value of the 10 ounces of gold. That was what he'd actually lost. If everything had gone well, he would have had the purchase price of 10 ounces of gold, about $6,000. And said the court he couldn't get back the value of the machine because his claim wasn't in conversion, it was a claim for false reversionary interest. On appeal, the High Court held that the owner had had a right to recover the machine because he hadn't been paid. Therefore, he did have a possessory interest in the machine. He had a right to recover possession of it. And he had that right at the time the defendants had gone ahead and sold the machine in defiance of his rights. Therefore, said the High Court, the owner could recover the true value of the machine, which was $30,000 at the time that the conversion took place. Obviously, in that case, the arrangement between the owner and the purchasers, to whom he'd agreed to sell the machine, was a very relevant one because if the reservation of property agreement had not provided, or had not existed, had not provided that, if it had provided perhaps a later date for the owner to recover possession, if the reservation of property agreement had been that the owner could recover possession after a certain date and before that it was converted, then the owner would not have had the necessary possessory interest, and the damages would have been much less. A difficult and perhaps hair-splitting kind of distinction. In England, the whole issue was discussed in the HSBC Rail case against Network Rail Infrastructure Limited. This, I guess, the English people are very familiar with this case. No? Okay. The plaintiff, HSBC, was the owner of railway carriages, which at least the Great Northern Eastern Railway, GNER, and GNER ran the carriages on tracks that were owned and operated by the Defender Network. One of these rails shattered, causing a derailment, and two of the carriages were total losses and were written off, and two others were severely damaged and were ultimately repaired with insurance money. Now, the whole thing was driven by insurance, clearly, and the important aspect of it for our purposes is that the owner, HSBC, wished to claim, or at least the owner's insurer, wished to claim against the third party, Network Rail, whose rails had caused, broken rails had caused the damage. It was accepted for the argument, Network accepted that its liability and it had negligently caused the losses that resulted, which ran into millions of pounds. The claim of HSBC, said the Court of Appeal, could not succeed. It's the same kind of reasoning as the case, the gold screening case in New Zealand, with a different result. In the gold screening case, ultimately it was held that the owner did have a right to regain possession of the gold screen, therefore could claim a conversion. This claim in the HSBC, the rail claim, was brought in negligence, which also requires a possessory interest in goods to be able to claim for damage. And the Court of Appeal there affirmed the rule, this case was in 2006, that there had to be a possessory interest, that is actual possession or a right to possession, for a person to bring proceedings and negligence. And here, said the court, the HSBC, the owner, had in any event suffered no damage, because the Bailey's insurance company had compensated HSBC. Now, normally in cases considering negligence, of course, the insurance position is neither here nor there as regards liability. But in this case, the court said because these carriages were leased to GNER, HSBC, their owner, had no right to possess them. The possession had been given to GNER, and therefore HSBC had no standing to bring in any claim in negligence or loss. So the position seems fairly clear that if an owner out of possession can sue for damage to a reversionary interest, but the cause of action cannot be conversion, trespass or negligence because they require a possessory interest. There's a good discussion of this in an article by Professor Tettenborn, who I think is an excellent I'm interested in, very often in the things he writes very much in the area that I'm interested in. And his article was discussed very closely by the Court of Appeal, his article on reversion of interest in the HSBC case. He said, well, we could perhaps avoid all these problems by saying, well, reversionary damage should just be one tort that encompasses conversion, trespass, and negligence, and that should be the end of it. However, he, after considering that idea, rejects it because he says each of these torts is different, has different elements, different requirements. They don't all want the same thing, they have to prove different things, and it's not possible to lump them together in that way. And the court in HSBC agreed with that and said that that must be right. But nevertheless, a claim for reversionary damage would depend upon proving the commission of one of the underlying torts of conversion, trespass or negligence. In other words, an owner out of possession, like the owner of the railway carriages, would have to, although he couldn't claim in conversion, trespass or negligence, would nevertheless have to show that, absent his title to sue, there still had been a talk of that kind committed. I think that is what it's worth, a bit questionable, because we have to bear in mind that an action for reversionary damage developed as an action on the case to get round the requirements of those existing torts. If an owner could have sued in negligence, conversion and so on, he would do so. The action that developed for reversionary damage was an action on the case because the other actions had become very rigid and owners out of possession could not establish that they had the necessary title. So whether it should be necessary to establish that one of those torts had been committed as the owner's title, I think is a strongly argued kind of question. The torts are all different in any event, and these days the courts have tended to require that conduct amounting to trespass has to be willful or negligent, and the courts will exclude unwitting or accidental acts from its ambit. And the history of trespass was reviewed in the well-known case of the National Coal Board and Evans. The reluctance on the part of the judiciary to find anybody liable in negligence for inadvertent acts no doubt goes some way to explaining why trespass is not particularly significant today. It's largely been taken over by negligence, because what has to be proved is much the same thing. Fault has to be proved. Conversion developed because of the narrowness initially of trespass. Trespass initially required a direct, forcible physical interference with property. The indirect results of it, the interference with title, are what conversion pretends. And these torts developed in a rigid, formulaic fashion, as is well known, the way that the old actions developed. In consequence, the reversionary action was one that developed to get round the rigidity of these torts. The reversionary action was to fill these gaps and to avoid the rigidity and the compartmentalisation of the torts themselves. So the action on the case, the action for a reversionary action, by its nature did not require proof of what those other torts actually required. It arose because the existing torts were inadequate for dealing with the position of dispossessed owners. Of course, these old rigid forms of action have gone, and now generally what in England, as I understand it, generally what's brought is an action for unlawful interference with goods. In New Zealand, we still look at it from the point of view of the individual torts. The arguments, of course, to allow a bailee to sue, nevertheless, clearly, I think, retain their cogency. There's very good reason for saying that a bailee should be able to sue. But it would seem to me that there's no reason that the bailee's right should be exclusive. And the reasons that apply to support a bailee's title to sue equally should apply to a bailor. In the HSBC case, the case about rail carriages, the Court of Appeal was asked to consider the idea, well, the law should be pleasingly symmetrical. A bailor should be able to, just as a bailor can sue, recover the whole loss and has to account to the bailor. If the bailor recovers more than his loss, why can't the law be the other way around? The bailor out of possession should be able to sue and then satisfy any claims of the bailee. The court rejected that, saying, no, it was well established that the possessory interest was the one that had to be protected. And Lord Justice Longmore said in HSBC, well, the reason for this is, as between bailee and a stranger, possession gives title. That is not a limited interest, but absolute and complete ownership. I think one can accept that, but the emphasis really is on the words as between bailee and stranger, And although the law allows, as between the bailee and stranger, the premise to be that the bailee has the complete title, I don't think it follows that the law then should say this means that the owner who's out of possession has no title at all. I don't think that follows as a matter of logic, or and I don't see any really good principle now to support that. Rather, what we have is two interests, the owner, the proprietary interest, and the possessory interest, which subsist concurrently in the same goods. Each of those interests is a limited one. Neither party has the total incidence of ownership in his hands. The bailee can suffer, say even if he suffered absolutely no loss, and the logic in refusing the bailor is one that I think doesn't necessarily follow. That isn't a particularly new idea. 100 years ago, Salmond wrote, and he wrote an essay in 1905 in the Law Quarterly Review, a very interesting article on throwback and conversion. And he said then, well, the market is some material differences between a present and reversionary interest, meaning a possessory and reversionary interest in goods. But he says it's irrelevant in respect to the nature of the injury committed. And if a reversionary owner can show he's been deprived of his property by the unlawful interference of the defendant, he has a good cause of action. And there's no subsisting reason why we should call a wrong so suffered by him by any other name than that of conversion. In other words, Salmond's view is that the owner of the right possession should be able to sue for conversion of his proprietary right. That view was endorsed by the Law Reform Committee in 1971. That's report which it produced before the 1977 Act was passed. The Law Reform Committee there said that they agreed with Salmond's view and considered that the remedy for wrongful interference should be open not only to a plaintiff who had at the material time actual possession or an immediate right to possession of the chattel, but also to a plaintiff who claims any other interest, or the present, future, possessory or proprietary not being an equitable interest in a chattel, provided he can show damage. The Law Reform Commission of British Columbia adopted the same stance in its report, which it did in 1992. The law, though, has not moved, so far as I know, in any jurisdiction to give effect to those recommendations. And of course, the recent cases we've had, the HSBC case in England and the Cameron Phelps case in New Zealand, confirmed the original position as being that an owner with no possessory interest at all in goods cannot claim in conversion or negligence. The gist of this, of course, or the gist of my argument is that although the law deems the bailee vis-a-vis a stranger to have complete title, there's no reason why that should exclude the bailor, who should equally be able to be deemed vis-a-vis a tortfeasor as somebody having a complete title. The issue here really is not the nature of the damage that's caused, but the standing of the owner to sue. And the problems that are there, I'd suggest, could be solved by relaxing the threshold requirement that the only interest protected by these torts is the possessory one, and should encompass also the proprietary interest of those owners of goods who have dispossessed themselves usually under contracts. So rather than requiring an owner to prove the commission of a tort as if the tort were the cause of action, it's more realistic, more direct, simply to allow the owner, in my view, to sue. If the law changed in this way, it's difficult to see that any prejudice would result. If the bailor sues, he would have to account to the bailee for any value of the bailee's interest that he might recover. I'm saying, as it happens now with the bailee. And of course, the tortfeasor is not concerned particularly with arrangements as between bailor and bailee. Generally speaking, those are not his concern. Further, the law at the moment, if a bailment is at will, allows both bailor and bailee to sue, and the law manages to do that without getting particularly upset. A more recent case involving Shell Oil and the fires at Buntsfield, has, in that case, the Court of Appeal has affirmed that a person with an equitable interest in goods, but with no possessory interest, is able to sue for damage to those goods. That was considered a questionable proposition in the past. But the Court of Appeal in the Shell against Total UK took the view that an equitable interest was sufficient and deserved protection in a negligence action, provided the owner of the goods was also joined in the action. The court was not concerned that the equitable owner should have a possessory interest. From this, I think it's not a big step to then say, well, the owner of a legal interest in goods, the proprietor of the goods, should also have the right to bring a claim in conversion or negligence. This seems to me to be not affected by anything in the English legislation by the 1977 Act, which really seems to have rationalised largely procedure rather than made any difference to the content of the torts that it covers and the kinds of interests that people might have to protect in those torts. I'll stop now and you can tell me I'm wrong.
We have about 15 minutes for questions. I know some people have to leave a bit early, so just feel free to step out.